Chapter 22. The String Wars. In this chapter, the vociferous critics of string theory, a long history of discontent, making sense of the criticism. String theory has aroused strong feelings since it first became a viable approach to the unification of physics in the early 1980s. Some consider it the culmination of science, others its debasement. The critics have been especially vociferous lately, taking their case to the public in lectures, books, and blogs. To what end? String theory and its discontents. Particle physicists don't call themselves high-energy physicists for nothing. The term technically refers to the high energies of the particles, but it could equally well refer to the people who study them. Compared to other physical scientists, such as astronomers and geologists, particle physicists have always struck me as people with strong personalities, strong opinions, and strong language. The atmosphere in university physics departments is more bracing than embracing. Every rule has its exceptions, of course, but by and large, they're not what I'd call laid-back types. This culture has helped to fuel the so-called string wars, the sometimes rancorous public debate over string theory. The discord has an edge that you seldom find elsewhere in the physical sciences. Both proponents and critics of string theory have been prone to exaggerate. If you read critics' books, you're left thinking that the best minds of our generation have been destroyed by the madness of string theory. If you read string theorists' works, you wonder why anyone would do anything else with their lives but get wrapped up in strings. Each side feels it's the aggrieved party. Critics see string theory as a steamroller crushing all other forms of theoretical physics in its path. String theorists think their critics are the steamrollers, prominent scientists who take their case to the public rather than hash it out in scientific journals and conferences. Picking a way through this minefield isn't easy. The 20 Years' Wars. Headlines such as Unraveling, About to Snap, and Epitaph make it sound like criticism of string theory is a new trend. Actually, it's nothing new at all. The tone was set in the mid-1980s, during the first string revolution, when string theorists' sweeping claims raised other physicists' hackles. In an opinion column in 1986, Paul Ginsparg and Sheldon Glashow wrote that their field threatened to break free of its experimental moorings and descend into murky contemplation to be conducted at schools of divinity by future equivalents of medieval theologians. They added, "For the first time since the Dark Ages, we can see how our noble search may end, with faith replacing science once again." The renowned physicist Richard Feynman said in a 1987 BBC interview, "I think all this superstring stuff is crazy." He elaborated, "I don't like that they don't check their ideas. I don't like that for anything that disagrees with experiment, they cook up an explanation." In a 1990 essay, Asim Barut wrote, "These objects, strings, are so far removed from our experience that I doubt whether such an endeavor is properly part of science or scientific method. Science was supposed to free us from the tyranny of belief. The new trend may take us a full circle back to the domain of beliefs." In the mid-90s, books by two science writers highlighted these concerns. David Lindley's tightly argued The End of Physics and John Horgan's more polemical The End of Science. Both argued that physicists might never be able to prove string theory right or wrong. They'd get lost in inconclusive debates. Students would choose other careers, and public interest would drain away. Fundamental physics would end not with a bang, but with a whimper. In 1999, string theorist Brian Greene published his best-selling book on string theory, The Elegant Universe, which led to a Nova miniseries in 2003. Not long after, mathematician Peter Woit, who is a particle physicist by training and temperament, started his blog, Not Even Wrong. The name alludes to a famous put-down that physicist Wolfgang Pauli once applied to a vacuous theory long before string theory came along. Woit has quickly become the most persistent and forceful critic of string theory. The blog developed into a book by the same name, which came out in 2006, around the same time as another critical book by physicist Lee Smolin, The Trouble with Physics. This 1-2 punch got a huge amount of attention, both inside and outside physics. Other critics have weighed in with their own books, lecture appearances, and colorful put-downs. Lawrence Krauss, Hallucination. Phil Anderson, Futile. Robert Laughlin, Too Much Lipstick. And João Maguello, Masturbation. But string theorists have not taken this criticism lying down. They have books and blogs of their own, although few respond with the same venom. The main exception is Lubos Motl's blog, which truly fights matter with antimatter. As long as you don't take his and Wojt's over-the-top comments too seriously, their blogs play a very useful role in defining the extremes of scientific opinion on string theory. If you think you understand something, test yourself by visiting these blogs and looking up what they have to say about the topic. If you can understand their comments and convince yourself you know how to respond, you've passed the Wojt-Motl test. Making sense of the complaints. This barroom brawl shouldn't be mistaken for a mass mood swing among physicists. Physics does go through swings, but this supposed backlash isn't one of them. Rather, it's largely a public relations affair. None of the criticism is new, and researchers have already made their choices about whether to pursue the theory or not. Few critics have actually done any work on string theory. That doesn't invalidate their criticism, but it does mean that the books and blogs aren't signs of an exodus from string theory. It just means that the critics happen to be talking louder right now. String theory is as intellectually vibrant, or not, as it has ever been. So what are we to make of the animus? Let me paraphrase the most common arguments and offer some thoughts. It's taking too long. Wojt writes that string theory has failed despite more than 20 years of effort. More than 20 years later, more than 20 years of intensive research. I lost track of how many times his book mentions 20 years. These remarks remind me of what happens when I get up in the morning. I set the alarm clock saying to myself, it can't possibly take more than a few minutes to jump in the shower, throw on some clothes, eat breakfast, read the paper, check my email, play with my daughter, and catch the train, so I might as well sleep in. And every morning, I rush out the door with half a bowl of cereal and an unopened newspaper left on the kitchen table. Things take time. We humans are notoriously bad at estimating how long they'll take. There's no 20-year shot clock in science. The United States launched the war on cancer in 1971, and HIV vaccine development in 1984. Each time, people predicted victory within a few years. In physics, over 70 years passed between the first shot in the quantum revolution and the triumph of the Standard Model. It's a good thing Wojt doesn't apply his 20-year rule consistently, or else he'd brand most of modern science, not just string theory, as an intellectual failure. Science is hard. Why should researchers abandon a strategy they consider promising just because they can't meet a silly deadline? It's not as if string theorists have been doodling and daydreaming for those 20 years. They've been exploring a very intricate theory. It might lead nowhere, but how can they know without checking it out? Even if it dead-ends, it won't have been a waste. String theory has already cross-fertilized other areas in physics and pure mathematics. When you're talking about cutting-edge science, you need to take the long view. It can't be tested. At the heart of the complaint that string theory is somehow not science is that it has yet to make a definitive experimental prediction, numbers that one can read off a dial to prove or disprove the theory. And the critics have a point. The remoteness of theory from experiment has always troubled string theorists, and loop theorists, and Bucky space theorists, and causal set theorists. All the proposed quantum theories of gravity are in the doghouse on this one. Gravity is weak, so its quantum features are very, very subtle. Even the narrower goal of grand unification, which leaves gravity to the side and tries to merge just the three forces of the Standard Model, is similarly remote. These are facts of life rather than reflections on string theory per se. I think we hear this complaint more about string theory than about, say, loop gravity, for those cultural reasons mentioned at the beginning of the chapter. String theory grew out of particle physics, and loop gravity grew out of relativity. Particle theorists have traditionally worked closely with experimenters, whereas relativity theorists have gone decades without data. Most of the early criticism of string theory came from the old guard of particle physics, who held it to the same standard as other particle theories. They expressed their dislike with characteristic particle physics directness. So, the string wars began as a family quarrel. Some string theorists thumbed their nose at the old guard by describing their theory as postmodern physics. They meant that lacking data, they'd have to evaluate it on other grounds, such as internal consistency. But they never thought they could get away without ever having to prove it. They just reckoned it'd take time to figure out how to do that. As discussed in Chapter 21, string and loop theorists have come up with lots of potential tests. Negative results wouldn't strictly disprove either theory, but that's par for the course. The history of science shows that new theories can seldom be ruled out so cleanly. They are gradually boxed in. Eventually, they either vindicate themselves or reach a tipping point where physicists flock to the alternatives. It can't explain anything. String theory's original ambition was to explain the observed world as the unique outcome of a few basic principles. It hasn't quite worked out. Theorists now think the laws governing our observable universe are just our local bylaws. Other regions of space can have different bylaws. String theory gives regions wide latitude to settle into their own local arrangements. The full set of permissible bylaws is known as the landscape. Some aspects of our bylaws may have no real explanation other than they have to allow for us humans to exist, or else we wouldn't be here to talk about it. If that's the case, then what good is string theory? To critics, it sounds like anything goes. The theory makes no firm predictions, so it can never really be tested and can't be called scientific. Yet string theory doesn't allow for absolutely any set of bylaws. It still establishes some core principles that all regions of space should abide by. If experimenters find aspects of our universe that violate those principles, they'll disprove the theory. In addition, some aspects of our bylaws might go beyond the strict requirements of our existence. They could reflect natural processes that single out certain bylaws over others. If so, string theory could at least partly live up to its original dream. It presumes the shape of space-time. String theory doesn't capture space-time in all its fluidity. To describe the force of gravity, string theorists first assume that space-time has a certain shape, and then imagine graviton particles flying around like baseballs during pre-game warm-up. A full-fledged quantum theory of gravity shouldn't need to assume anything. The shape of space-time should arise organically. For loop theorists, such as Smolin, this is string theory's main defect. It's a fair point. In the jargon, string theory isn't background independent. On the other hand, this deficiency doesn't prevent string theorists from describing any gravitational situation by taking a series of snapshots of space-time. It may not be as impressive as a full movie, but the difference is one of presentation. Both a movie and still frames represent the same scene. In other words, the lack of fluidity doesn't seem to be a failing of the theory per se, but of the mathematical tools that theorists use to express it. It suffers from groupthink. Why, the critics ask, if string theory is so flawed, do so many physicists persist with it? Their answer is some personal defect of the string theorists themselves: arrogance, narrow-mindedness, or herd mentality. In defense of this claim, the critics trot out anecdotes, such as silly things string theorists have said over the years. Without a detailed sociological analysis, it's hard to know what to make of this. It's the kind of claim that people always make when they dislike what other people are doing. Indeed, string theorists have said much the same of the critics themselves. So where does that leave us? Many people on both sides seem awfully convinced that they're right and the other side is wrong. How can they be so sure? This is quantum physics, after all, which doesn't have a reputation as the world's easiest subject. A more straightforward explanation is that researchers have a legitimate difference of opinion. The science is complex and unsettled. There are good reasons for smart people to pursue string theory, and good reasons for equally smart people to question it. Everyone makes his or her own judgment. Right now, the majority have thrown in their lot with string theory. Public hectoring won't change that. What would is if someone came along with a more compelling alternative. My theory is better. It's easy to criticize, harder to offer a better idea. To the extent that critics have done that at all, most advocate exploring the nooks and crannies of current theories, waiting for new data, and inching forward. And there's something to be said for that. Every now and then, a theorist discovers some unexpected phenomenon lurking within current theories, a reminder that they're incompletely understood. Such incremental efforts used to be more popular, but the cancellation of the superconducting supercollider pulled the rug out from under them. Waiting for new data came to look like waiting for Godot. In the past couple of years, as the Large Hadron Collider has geared up, many physicists have gone back to pushing the standard model one step, and only one step, further. As a way to unify physics, though, the incremental approach has come up empty-handed. The failure of early incremental approaches is what led so many physicists to pursue string theory. By the early 1980s, experiments had ruled out grand, unified theories proposed by Glashow and others, and physicists were casting around for a more radical approach. Because general relativity and quantum theory have complementary problems, it might actually be easier to solve them by lunging for a final theory rather than trying to inch forward. In retrospect, it turns out that even the incremental study of standard quantum theory would probably have led physicists to something like string theory anyway. According to the so-called gravity gauge duality, souping up the standard model naturally gives us string theory. Quantum leap. If there's one thing everyone can agree on, it's that the system for funding science has become a nightmare. One way scientists get money to do their work is by applying for grants from government agencies such as the U.S. National Science Foundation. But the system is horrendously inefficient. Some scientists find they spend more time writing grant applications than doing research. Out-of-the-box ideas and young scientists are often left out in the cold. A National Academy of Sciences panel in 2005 argued for special grants to help young researchers start their careers and to enable high-risk, high-payoff research. Some critics, notably Smolin, Roger Penrose, and Gerard Tooft of Utrecht University, fall into a different category. Their real beef isn't with string theory, but with what they see as the relative neglect of other approaches. Smolin, for one, has predicted that loop gravity and string theory will eventually merge to take advantage of their offsetting strengths and weaknesses. He was a founding faculty member of the Perimeter Institute, the only place in the world where proponents of all the theories work under a single roof. For their part, string theorists are less likely than they once were to dismiss loop gravity out of hand. Many now have at least a passing familiarity with it. Green notably commends Smolin's vision of an eventual merger. Not much else has come of these olive branches, though. String theorists find loop gravity as inadequate as loop theorists find string theory. The two groups start from such different premises and come from such different cultures that they may never have a true meeting of the minds. Most physicists are very open about the deficiencies of the theory they work on. It's a matter of emphasis. Are these deficiencies teething pains or death blows? Reasonable people can disagree. I personally think it's great that physicists take a multitude of approaches and occasionally borrow ideas from one another. My main concern is that the harshness of the debate backs people up against the wall, making them less willing to listen to constructive criticism or trawl for ideas outside their own subfield. As a result, the world might have to wait that much longer for a quantum theory of gravity to emerge. The least you need to know. String theory has always had prominent critics, although they've gotten more vocal lately. Critics say the theory is taking too long to develop and doesn't make firm experimental predictions. Many of the complaints have an element of truth, but apply not only to string theory but also to all the proposed theories. One thing is undoubtedly true: all the proposed theories are still works in progress.